My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N. I'm with Major General G-J-J, or is it
G-J-J?
G-J-J Edwards, DFC, CD. General Edwards was with the RCAF and later the Canadian Forces. And the date today is 18 July, 1979, and we're at General Edwards' home in North Saanich, I guess, or Central Saanich.
North.
North. We call it North Saanich here. General Edwards, last time that we were talking, we got pretty much the social life of 428 Squadron. And I was thinking now today, if we could, we'd go into the operational aspects of the squadron itself. And I guess, refresh your memory, where were you stationed exactly again? It was
428 was at Middleton, St. George, in... I can never remember whether it was North Yorkshire or south County Durham up there, but very, very close to the border, Yorkshire-Durham border. Two squadrons on Middleton St. George, 419 and 428. And I joined, looking at my logbook, I joined 428 on, I think, about the 23rd or 24th of March, 1944.
Now, you would be preparing bomber-wise for the, the invasion of Normandy. Is that correct? Or were you...
Yes. Of course, we didn't know at the time, but I see during March, April, and May... We were on Halifax 2s, and for the most part, we were doing, I see, marshalling yards in northern France, Belgium, and the odd nip into Germany, but a high percentage of the operational pattern was what we call gardening, mining, and we mined all the way from Oslo Fjord in the north, through off Heligoland Bight, Kiel, and then down into northern France.
Now, what would be the tactics for mining as opposed to bombing?
It seemed to me that we... My recollection is vague here, and I didn't put down any altitudes against those operations, but it seemed to me that we were dropping mines by parachute from about 1,000 feet, and, of course, always at night. And I would... This mining was astride along the west coast of Europe, seemed to be astride... likely routes taken by German coastal shipping. We'd do the whole thing at night. We would go out low and stay low. Those tactics to keep us below radar coverage off the west coast of Europe, and. We mined on bearings from known landmarks, and in those days we were picking them up. We were picking the landmarks up with our H-2S aircraft radar.
What about Oboe and things like that? Would you not be?
We didn't. The straight bomber didn't have Oboe. We had G. What we call H-2S radar. We learned later on that the emanations from our H-2S gave the German night fighter force in the case of bomber command pretty good fixes on where we were, and they were homing in on our streams using emanations from H-2S.
So, now would you have No, you wouldn't have this oval thing, which was, you know, you could tell by the signal where you were exactly.
Well, G did that.
No, G did that as well.
G did that, but the coverage was heavy throughout England, and stretched out over the North Sea and into northern France. But you ran out of the range of G as you flew east. You ran out of the range of G rather quickly. We were able to use G certainly all through the northern France, Belgian coast, as the coast turned more easterly when you got up by Holland and Denmark and Norway, we ran out. So we would use G as far as we could. And then if we needed a precise fix, we'd snap on H2S quickly.
Now, you didn't know that the Germans could pick up the H2S signal, is that correct?
That never came up in any of our briefings. I have a feeling that we knew at that point in time, but
you were not told.
We were not told. Although much later on, we certainly were told, and were told to keep the H2S off.
Now, what about fighter escort now, because you're in coastal as opposed to going right into Germany?
Yeah, no fighter escort with the night formations that I was aware of at all. We did all of this at night. There would be intruder sweeps to try and keep night fighters down. You may remember that in was it southern Denmark or northern Holland? Flensburg was a major night fighter base, also a training base. And when we mined, say, up off Heligoland, or the sea, we went into Kiel a couple of times. We knew that we were venturing very, very close indeed to a nest of very skillful night fighters. But very few losses on gardening, as I recall. We went out low, we stayed low. It was a fairly short run. You got rid of your mines quickly. You really weren't over enemy land territory. You were over enemy water, certainly. But the reaction to gardening, as I recall, tended to be minimal.
Was that considered a good exercise, or poor, or what?
Well, it wasn't a very exciting one. You did the whole thing at night. Hopefully you didn't see a damn thing. Of course, they had flak ships out there, and every now and then someone would wander close to one, and you'd see a flak ship suddenly explode on your port starboard, dead ahead or behind, and you just were damn thankful that you had missed it. But they scattered them in a random pattern, I think, down that coast. So we knew we were in unfriendly territory, but we sensed that the risk was not as great, say, as a penetration into Stuttgart, where you had to run the gauntlet in and out. Sort of 75-80% of this operation was over so-called friendly territory water.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a minimum amount of time.
Now, how many mines would you pack, type of thing? How large were they, do you recall?
I don't recall precisely, but it seemed to me that we carried about... This was a relatively short flight. These operations rarely lasted more than 5 hours. So you were sort of a couple of hours over, a couple of hours back, and then an hour for the takeoff and the landing max. Seems to me that we carried 6 or 8 1,000-pound, maybe even 10 1,000-pound mines with parachute attached.
No, would they be set up in the bomb boy bay so you could just let them go?
You handle them just like a bomb. No difference.
What about the fusing device? Now, would it be like a bomb? Would it have a little propeller or fuser as it was going down, or were they live?
There was obviously some fusing device, and as they left the aircraft, the device was activated. So when they hit the water. On the other hand, they may have left the aircraft. There may have been some dissolving process. Once they hit the salt water, they activated after, say, mm-hmm. 15 minutes in the water. I don't recall much more.
You were too busy flying, I guess, at the time.
Well, and it never really occurred. They said you were going to mine, and you went out and mined, and you
mm-hmm.
didn't. You got a little more detail on bomb loads. You knew what the fusing was, and you knew that the bomb was going to activate itself so many thousand feet after release and so on. But you were flying at much higher altitudes then.
Well, General Edwards, now you're what rank were you holding at this time?
I was a flight lieutenant through July 1944, and became a squadron leader sometime in August.
Now, you flew the Halifax until when? You were saying
the Halifax 2 on 428. I flew until the end of May, and I see that the first of the Canadian Lancasters, the Lancaster 10, had put in an appearance probably late May, and I had my first familiarization flight in one on the 2nd of June, and did my first operation in the Lank 10 on the 14th of June.
So how did that feel to get this new plane? I mean, it was the plane to have, was it not?
It was the most advanced Lancaster at that point in time, Canadian built. Seemed to be as I remember, you know, it was a much more graceful aircraft than much more graceful looking, but also looked rather more fragile than the old lumbering Halibag 2. But it had more power, and we were proud that we were flying a Canadian aircraft. The Halifaxes, of course, were UK built.
What about this Canadian aircraft? Because it was Canadian built, it meant more to you that you were.
Well, I don't think it was a major emotional event, but you know, one sensed it was our aircraft, higher speed, carried a better bomb load, all round had a better performance. So we were pleased to get any help, and the Halifax too was getting pretty long in the tooth. It was. At the bottom, I think only the Halibag 1 was older. But they both aircraft had Rolls-Royce
Merlin engines.
Certainly the Halifax 2 did. I think the Lank 10. No, I think the Lank 10 had a Merlin as well. What have I got here? Yeah, here we are. The old Halifax 2 had what was known as the Merlin 20, and the Lank 10 had what was called a Merlin 38. And then going on, later I flew the Halifax 3, and that had a Hercules 16 in it.
What about individual differences now between the Halifax and the, for flying, between, say, the Halifax and the Lancaster?
It was.
I'm just thinking of peculiarities between the planes.
They were both very stable aircraft. They were good instrument platforms, and we were doing most of our work at night. I mentioned that the Lank 10 had all round had a higher performance. It was more responsive. If you had to do any evasive action, say on a real or imagined fighter attack, the Halifax 10. Responded very, very quickly indeed. It was a good aircraft. We were delighted with them, but as I say, they looked more fragile. They were rather sleeker, and they.
What about firepower? Did you feel more protected with the Lancaster?
No, there was no difference. You know, there was no protection against. There was no significant protection against anti-aircraft or a fighter.
You didn't want to trade your Lancaster, say, for a Flying Fortress, so. No.
Never even occurred. Never, and we were so certain that everything that we flew was vastly superior to anything that our American cousins flew. We felt very, very sorry for them.
Well, they were on the daylights,
and they were on the daylights, and we knew they were taking a hell of a beating. We didn't. I see here. I didn't get into daylights until my first daylight was in. On June the 15th, in a 1944 in a Lank 10. And we were doing, and we had fighter support here, I see. We were doing a daylight on the Boulogne submarine pens.
Would it be the St. Nazarene pens as well, or is that, is this a...
No, Boulogne.
Boulogne.
No, St. Nazaire, we did separately a little later on.
A little later, okay.
A little later on, yeah.
Two things. How does the daylight bombing, I gather, would be formation, whereas nighttime was a gaggle, is that correct?
Both were gaggles.
Both were gaggles.
Both were gaggles, and yeah. Most of us hadn't seen what we looked like at night until we saw the daylight gaggle. Now, the daylight gaggle obviously was a little more compact, but it was a column of lump headed in one direction. We did not fly formation. We flew a broad positional pattern and tried to keep the gaggle fairly tight, not in a formation sense, but as tight as we could, because we were given fighter protection. We realized that...
What kind of fighters are this? Would these the Mustang type thing or what?
Mustang, although on some of these very close ones, you see, going into... Going to Boulogne, just across the channel, we probably had anything that Fighter Command could provide.
Spits and Hurricanes. Yeah.
Spits and Hurricanes, even at that stage.
They were to be lumbering along and see some Spits fly by.
We envied them. We just sat there, as you say, lumbered, heavily loaded, a very very poor rate of climb when you got much above about. Well, certainly above 15,000 feet, you had to struggle for every additional foot of altitude. And these fighter aircraft would zap by and wiggle wings. We couldn't even afford to wiggle our wings, or you'd lose 100 feet. So it was a straight case of envy, I would say.
Now, would there be any communication between fighter and bomber, or were you keeping radio silence?
We kept radio silence, we even in even on daylights they were using a master bomber technique, so we were dropping on colored target indicators and listening out for a master bomber as he moved the attack in relation to these ground target indicators that he had dropped or the Pathfinder force had dropped. We listened out, but we were under strict orders not to open our mouths. And discipline is good.
So you weren't yelling to other people to watch out for this or that?
Not
like the movies.
Not in my experience. And remember, much of the movies is based on American daylights, and they certainly were chattering back and forth.
The Americans would chatter
in a defensive way. We could hear them sometimes, as you ran down your radio frequencies from time to time, you could hear them. Perhaps on deeper penetrations or forming up or that sort of thing. They seem to talk a lot, which we deplored.
Was there any cases, I know General Lane was saying, cases where somebody had left his radio on inadvertently?
Yeah.
And you could hear a guy babbling away?
Yeah. You could hear the internal chatter of the crew that was supposed to be coming across only on internal intercom, but every now and then someone would leave him. Or a button would stick open. A transmitting button would stick open. And this guy would be broadcasting the whole way. And you cursed him. Because certainly on night raids, night operations, an open mic also provided a homing capability within your stream. A mm-hmm. homer for the...
night fighter.
For the night fighter.
What was the... the view of the night fighter in that the German Air Force did virtually what the RAF did in the Battle of Britain. Now it was over their territory. They could, had twice the gas that you had, could get up, get down, pick you up on the way over, get down, refuel, pick you up on the way back, this sort of thing. What was the feeling about them?
We had the greatest respect for them. As you flew in, I'm talking daylights now. But as you flew in at night, you could see within the night bomber formation and you expected they were aircraft within your raid, being attacked by night fighters. You could see the tracer all around, and you see bombers going down on all sides. So as soon as you saw that happen, you doubly alerted all crew members to watch out.
Well, what was the feeling when you saw a bomber beside you sort of just falling out of the sky? I guess would be the best description.
You felt your first instinct, the poor bastard, they've got him. Whether it be a night fighter or if he were coned by searchlights, and the AK-AK seemed to be zeroing in particularly heavily, and every now and then you'd see a flash in the sky and you knew he was being hit. Your first instinct was sympathy for him, but followed very quickly by increased apprehension for the safety of your own aircraft.
What about these flak towers and things? What were they? The anti-aircraft. How did you view them?
Well, these were. I think most of the stuff we saw weren't so-called flak towers. They were. Anti-aircraft emplacements, whether it be a point coverage or zone coverage, there were flak belts you had to fly through, and certainly around cities there were flak belts all around, staged well out in an attempt to pick off the attacking aircraft before they got to the heart of the city or the submarine pen or whatever. Flak towers were used, as I recall, more against low-flying intruders. But we were simply the nature of the type of flak defense usually was not described to us. We were simply advised that there was heavy flak concentration. Some of this mobile too, and we were led to believe that our intelligence was able to give us the new positions of these mobile flak batteries, and they varied. But as you looked at an operational map when you were being briefed, you saw these great zones of red astride your operational path going in, your flying path going in, or great blotches of red, say, around a target like Stuttgart or Stettin, and around all German and French, Belgian, Dutch, and Danish cities. And you were advised to expect a heavy flak concentration.
Well, when it came up, what was it like sitting up front? I'm thinking of the movies again where you see these big black puffs of smoke or whatever.
Well, course, at night we didn't see black puffs. We saw flashes as the AK-AK shell exploded. In daylights, we saw the black puffs.
Could you smell the cordite type thing? Or?
Yeah, every now and then you'd obviously fly. You would fly right through a puff of this smoke, and you could smell it. And every now and then, if you were hit, you knew the aircraft
responded.
It felt it if it was a heavy hit. But every now and then, you'd get a, what would it be? Almost like a stuttering static on the aircraft that you could hear, and this was expended flak. You'd be so far away from the main impact of an AK-AK shell exploding in the air that you'd only get the little splinters of steel, and the energy would be so expended that they'd simply be peppering the aircraft without penetrating it. But you could hear this.
They're knocking on the door, eh?
Knocking on the door, and you realize that they were coming close. Really, those red flak belts, when you looked at them prior to an operation.
Take a pause here. You're on the air again. You were saying when you looked at these red flak belts before.
On the operational maps in the briefing room, the map usually would be covered up by a sliding curtain of some kind, and when the briefer pulled the chain and opened the map, you could hear the groan of the crews as you looked at a
these flak belts.
As you looked at flak belts. They were done in, they were superimposed on the map in transparent red, but they were looked as ominous as hell. In the event, the flak perhaps looked more serious, more dangerous, more inhibiting than it actually turned out to be. But the flak, of course, tended to keep you high and
keep you alert,
and certainly keep you alert. And they had all sorts of, you know, they had proximity fuses, they had delayed fuses, and they used to send a thing up to try and unnerve the crews. I've forgotten what it was. I forgot the name we had for it, but when it got up to whatever the altitude of the formation, the gaggle, the night gaggle might be, this thing burst into flames and looked like an aircraft that had been hit, now on fire, was falling. And it was a it was a psychological weapon. It wouldn't do any damage to an aircraft unless it hit it directly. But you'd see these flamers going down, and clearly the Jerrys are trying to give you the impression that they were knocking a great many more aircraft down than they actually were.
How effective do you think was the anti-aircraft fire?
Well, I say it certainly influenced the routing a force would take going in, and no doubt affected your bombing altitude. You tended to go in high, and that in itself produced a measure of bombing inaccuracy. The lower you could go in, the more accurate your bombing was expected to be. So it.
Well, we're talking in the same area. What about the night fighter? Now they had these things where they would come underneath you. I believe. And now, would you be constantly?
No, you were flying until you apprehended a night fighter attack. You flew essentially straight and level. That was the fastest way in and the fastest way out. Straight and level with your gunners, your tail, mid, upper, and sometimes a belly gunner as well. Just scanning their areas behind you, and notifying you of any movement that they could detect. And very often you'd hear from the tail gunner that there was a Lancaster or a Halifax or something at 7 o'clock sliding under. Now, early on we didn't worry much about anything identified as our own aircraft. But you may remember that the Jerrys recovered and rebuilt a number of crashed bomber command aircraft, armed them to the teeth, and got them up into the stream, and they would slide around, and you just didn't like any aircraft near you after you learned about these tactics. I don't know how successful that technique was, but it kept you on your toes. And I remember crews mentioning that they had been fired upon by a Lancaster or a Halifax. Now, question: was it a German? Was it a German armed one, or one of our own just reacting to someone sliding near him? So it could have been. It could have been brother firing on cousin, but you never stopped to worry about that.
Well, what about this business where, like, the night fighters got, like, at this late stage in the war, they became so adept that they would have, what, these almost vertical cannons?
That's right.
And they would just sort of slide under. A punch and just slide away as you went tumbling down.
I never had the experience myself, but whether they were vertical fires or forward firing. And of course, the speed differential was considerable. We were belting along there at the magnificent speed of maybe 150 miles an hour, and of course these fighters would be could be operating at 350. So at night, and of course these night fighter pilots had all the homing devices on their side, ground direction, their own internal aircraft devices, plus highly developed night vision. And if they ever got into a stream, they could do a hell of a lot of damage. We were attacked once, and it was a straight stern attack, and he was above us, and we assumed he was attacking us. He could have had his eyes on another aircraft, one of our aircraft close by that we couldn't see, but we took immediate evasive action and shook him. But he fired and we fired, and we both missed.
How difficult was it to hit a night fighter? I can imagine the gunners were just...
Yeah, we had...
their guns or what?
Yeah, we had 303s. No, the gunners were trained not to fire in a panic-stricken way, to pick it off, because your own tracer emanating from your aircraft would give you away as well. So you didn't. I remember as you crossed coming in, as you crossed the water coming in, both gunners would clear their guns, fire their guns, hopefully well clear of any friendly aircraft. I don't think we shot anybody down of our own, and I don't think we hit any night fighters either. Of the two defenses, ACAC versus night fighter, we were much more sensitive to a night fighter, and had the greatest respect.
They were plenty scary, I guess.
Well, we hoped we'd give them a wide berth.
During this time, too, there was these great raids, 1,000-plane raids and all this other sort of thing. Were you ever involved with that type of operation or close?
Yeah, I think... We weren't very often told exact numbers going in, but I don't think I was ever in a 1,000-plane raid. I may have been.
Well, I use that as the example.
Yeah, right. But it seems to me that I remember learning that on... forgot what it was. Was it Stuttgart, Stettin, or Brunswick, Bremen? One of these. That... there were some 850 aircraft involved on that target. Now, of course, in addition to the aircraft on that target, there would be other aircraft in varying numbers on other targets.
Targets, yes.
So on any one night, there probably would be many more than 1,000 aircraft out over France, Germany, Belgium, Holland, and so on. But,
what I'm getting at is I'm trying to think, if you're flying in a gaggle to start with, would it be like elevating different heights all the way down type of thing?
Yeah.
How would they,
yeah.
What would you be instructed?
Well, you were given a specific altitude to reach at a specific point. And that gave you a stagger then. That gave the gaggle a stagger in depth, and you had a stagger in time as well. So I suppose if you could take a picture of the thing at any point in time, it would be like a flying wedge with the... I expect, and it would vary, I expect the cutting edge of the wedge would be at the highest altitude, with the rest coming in behind, although you could have had a reverse of that. You could have had the early attack on a target. Attack on a target, time over target for a whole raid, might be as much as 20-25 minutes.
Are you just continually circling, or what?
No, you're operating individually. You went in on your own flight plan at a specified time at a specified altitude, and when you dropped your bombs, you had similar tactics to come out. You were either to climb, dive, remain at the same altitude, and you tracked out. But if you like,
be all in one pass, though, is that right?
No, wave after wave would be coming in, say at one minute intervals. Let's say it was a thousand aircraft raid on Berlin, and if that raid lasted over 20 minutes, you'd have 100 aircraft per minute. coming in at minute intervals at different altitudes, as much protection for the formation as it was to stagger the well. The staggering of the raid over a particular target when you were dealing with 1,000 aircraft was really to protect the formation, to give them a spread.
So they
weren't dumping on each other or mid-air colliding. And
there was enough of that anyway.
And there was. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much. Very surprisingly, on the two squadrons I was with, I didn't hear of a single mid-air collision, and I don't recall any aircraft coming back having. There were some near misses, mm-hmm. alleged, but I don't recall any aircraft coming back. You know, having. having say bashed in a wingtip because he slid too close to another wing.
I was thinking now you're we can go back to your log, I guess. We're talking May, June 1944. We have the invasion on the 6th of June 1944. Where were you and what were your reactions, do you recall, to the Normandy invasion?
I flew on the 5th of June at night, and we were flying over England. It was a training flight. We were flying in the south of England, and we were using our H2S, which had a fairly wide scatter. And I recall the navigator saying, there's an island out there in the English Channel that I just can't identify, either that or this damn set is unserviceable. And of course, on reflection later, that's the following day, what he was seeing was the
Armada.
The invasion fleet, the Armada, yeah. Moving across, and he was getting a major return
land
on
form.
It. Yeah. There was great concern. We didn't have very much information on it. Of course, the English papers carried very little other than the fact that the attack was underway, but the secrecy surrounding it. Remember, we were in North Yorkshire, so mm-hmm. wouldn't have much local information about it. And of course, the papers were giving absolute minimum because the Germans at that time didn't know whether it was a diversionary or the major attack or what. So we didn't.
Well, now, did the RAF have air supremacy at this time, as if, in the sense of the Channel area and the coast, the virtual air supremacy?
Yes, yes, certainly, great superiority, bordering on supremacy. There were still night attacks. You see, it was one thing to have fighter supremacy against enemy fighter aircraft or indeed bombers daylight,
mm-hmm.
but the night fighter capability was still a relatively marginal one, and an aggressive. Clever enemy at night could slip in, slip out, and still do a hell of a lot of damage.
Did you ever, before we got to Normandy, sort of on the side, Bomber Harris had the famous Blue Book that I'm sure you're aware of now,
yeah.
Today, but did you ever hear about the Blue Book or ever see that type of, I guess, PR job while you were actually flying?
I don't recall knowing anything about the Blue Book at that point.
I guess what I'm getting at is how effective did you perceive your raids to be? You see, because we have varying. It's difficult today because, if you look at Dr. Douglas' new book on Out of the Shadows, Canada, the Second War, there's statistics for whatever statistics are worth. Claim Bomber Command is total. It affected German war production. In the grand scheme by 1.2% or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
So very negligible considering the great cost in both mm-hmm. lives, equipment, and
mm-hmm.
everything else. And then, on the other hand, there was Bomber Harris in his blue book and just showing, you know, half of Europe decimated. You know, anywhere there's blue, there's no more. I'm just trying to think how you, at that time, perceived your effectiveness.
Oh, we thought we were doing a hell of a job. Although you would come back from a raid and realize that it hadn't gone well. I recall one night over Brunswick where we expected to go in and clear, and Brunswick was completely covered with cloud. So we were bombing then on target indicators that were being dropped above us by the Pathfinder force by parachute, and these were floating TIs, and the bomber force was coming in and bombing on a floating target indicator. So we felt that we weren't you could see the bomb loads going down, reflecting up through the cloud cover. We didn't have a clue, and we suspected we weren't being very effective that night. And there were instances like that. But you'd come back from a target and feel that you'd hit it very, very well indeed, on the basis of the fires on the ground and the.
What about the photographs and things? What about air photos now? Would you be looking at them very often?
Yeah, every bomber aircraft took its own photo, and you were given a copy of it. If not that night, the following day.
And then what, would you go over your pattern? And
you'd go over your, you would have an aiming point, and you would look hard at these photographs. Some of them came out absolutely great. It was just too damn much light overexposed. But you'd look, and you know, essentially your target was the very middle of the photograph. But that was a bit of a myth too, because of course, unless you were flying, these were vertical cameras, unless you were flying absolutely straight and level, and I mean absolutely straight and level, any little tilt at all would tilt the camera, and you
get an oblique or an oblique.
And you get a relatively, it wouldn't appear oblique, but you'd get a little roll to it, and you'd move, if you were 20,000 feet, you know, you'd move your square several hundred feet on the ground, so you didn't. But to return to your earlier question, we knew that if we weren't hitting the exact plan aiming point, if you were hitting an industrial city, you sure as hell knew that you'd kept the workers up all night. I don't think many people would sleep through the kind of raids that that Bomber Command would put down in a major way on them.
I guess what I'm trying to think now. For me, of course, it's reading and trying to think on my own, but the British people came through the Battle of Britain very successfully. They hit the tube stations, the subways, they slept there, and they got up and they worked hard, and war production increased, it didn't decrease, and they took it on the chin, if you will, and survived very well. Yet the feeling was that the German production and the German people, the whole place would come down like a house of cards, was almost the attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering,
mm-hmm.
for myself, I'm wondering why or how that attitude could develop, and if indeed it did develop with you.
Well, you will recall that during the heavy bombing raids, they tended to concentrate in the London area, although other cities were hit.
Mm-hmm.
The bomb tonnage being dropped then was comparatively light. When one looked at what a combination of Halifax's, Lancaster's, Flying Fortresses, Liberators, etc., were tending to dump. So you felt confident there that you were pounding them a hell of a lot harder than the Jerrys ever were able to pound.
No, I don't think there's any dispute about that. I guess it's the psychological that. Understandably that our people are better and can take it.
Yeah.
And that type of thing. But I guess it's the assumption that the German people could not take it on the chin, and that war production could not be as flexible, say, as it was in Britain. Or
yeah, that was a widely held view, and we were not discouraged in holding it.
Okay.
We,
Your actual effectiveness, though, well, what do you think of Douglas's figures, though, in the sense that your actual effect, the whole of Bomber Command's effect on German war production was, you know, a few percentage points. Can you accept that at all?
I can't believe that we were as good as we thought we were.
Okay.
But how far one can back off on that? 1, 2, 3% seems incredibly low, and I would have to believe that the cumulative effect, the combination of disruption night after night of the workforce, and we did it night after night after night, the requirement for movement, the whole psychological effect must have given a cumulative total significantly greater than a simple effect.
Well, Albert Speer, of course, is the other way. He said if you had kept it up, you know, in particular areas, the whole thing would have fallen.
Gone. Yeah.
No, I just thought I'd throw that up because it's an interesting dispute. With D-Day itself, back to 44, now you're switching over in June to the Lancaster, is that correct?
Yep.
And so through June, you're flying this new plane. How were your casualty losses and things with your squadron? Do you recall? Was it good, bad?
After about May of 1944, to my recollection, I really can't be that precise.
Mm-hmm.
Losses did drop. And none of us had a... We were on a squadron, on a station, and we simply were not provided total losses for our group. We didn't particularly press for them. We didn't really know how the group...
I was just thinking of the squadron itself.
Yeah.
You knew who was there and who
you
wasn't.
You knew who was there and losses. If you lost out of a squadron effort of, say, 15 aircraft, one or two aircraft would, which would be about 10%, would be high. And what was happening, we were perhaps losing an aircraft on every... two or three raids, and that seemed very tolerable to us. And as it transpires, the group as a whole dropped significantly. They picked up again a little later on. The daylight raids